Happy Easter to everybody. This is episode 353, dated Friday, March 29th, 2024.
You are listening to the In Perspective weekly podcast with Bob Branco and Peter O'Toole.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to In Perspective. My name is Bob Branco. Good to be here again. Happy Easter to everybody. This is episode 353, dated Friday, March 29th, 2024. As usual, let me welcome our good friend, Peter O'Toole. Peter, what's going on?
It's a glorious day in the Coos Bay neighborhood, and it's supposed to be nice for the next several days, so we can open our doors and air out the house, and it's just a terrific period of time, and spring is coming. It's not quite here yet, but it's coming.
We've been having a lot of rain here. Hopefully it's over with. We'll have a nice Easter weekend. A little on the chilly side, but very bearable. Before we continue, let me thank those people who make it possible for In Perspective to be made available. We have our producer, Raymond Gay. Thank you for what you do. Tom and Lynn from Rosie's Place Chatline. Thank you for posting our programs. Our media outlets, thank you very much for airing our shows when you do. It's much appreciated. And last but certainly not least, Jacqueline Sylvia of JS Web Solutions, thank you for archiving our programs. To find the archives, just go to my website, which is www.brancoevents.com. Arrow down till you get to In Perspective Podcasts. Click on those, and you will see our archives from latest to earliest, at least most of them anyways.
Merci, Jackie.
And thank you, Trish, for hosting our show today. We appreciate it very much. Frequently on our show, we invite scholarship winners from the American Council of the Blind to be with us, and today is no exception. I would like to introduce Marco Ramos and welcome him on our program. First of all, congratulations on being a scholarship winner.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
And welcome to our show. We appreciate having you.
It's great to be here.
You have several things to talk about today, as you mentioned in a previous email that we exchanged. But before we get into that, I just want to find out how you came to win your scholarship and what are you doing today?
Sure. So I heard of the scholarship first from BPI. I'm a BPI member.
Just to interrupt for a second. BPI is the Blind Pride International.
Blind Pride International.
The of ACB adults with LGBTQ issues, just because we have an audience who doesn't always know what that means.
Right. So Blind Pride International is a special interest affiliate of ACB. And I also received an application from my university's Disability Support Service office. And so I said, you know what? I've heard of the ACB scholarships from two channels. This might be a sign. I'm going to, you know, get an application together, and I did. So that's how I got the scholarship.
And the rest is history.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you're attending school right now, correct?
Yes, I'm in my fourth year of the PhD program in English Literature and Criticism. I'm at the Indiana University of Pennsylvania in Indiana, PA. It's about an hour from Pittsburgh. Yeah, and I'm in my fourth year. I'm currently teaching at the university as well. This is my teaching year. It's been fun. It's been really nice. I have a bunch of exams scheduled within the next semester or so. I'm probably going to be done with all my exams probably by fall. So I'm pretty excited about that. A little terrified, but also excited. Hoping to get all of that done by the end of the year, hopefully.
Based on what you told me in your intro, Marco, I'm going to take a guess here, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but Do you have a career in journalism, Mike?
No. So I've been writing. It's been one of my constants. Not in journalism, but I do more creative writing. I'm a creative writer. And well, because now that I'm in the academe, it's also, well, publish or perish. So I also write professionally for publication for more academic and scholarly stuff. Yeah, but yeah, so it's basically a lot of writing for me. Even my side hustles are all writing jobs, some grant writing, you know, and stuff like that, technical writing and other things. So it's really, writing's really the constant for me.
You're a grant writer. That's very honorable. I don't know very many grant writers.
It is hard. It is difficult, but yeah. So that's my side hustle, but really my main job is teaching. I am a teacher by training. So yeah. And then I do a little bit of writing on the side.
Excellent.
So how long do you anticipate after you pass your exams, which I'm sure you'll do in flying colors, how many years left do you think you have to?
So after my exams, I want to finish my dissertation in about 18 months or about 18 to 24 months, about 2 years more. So I'm eyeing to graduate by either May or December of 26. I don't want it to drag it any longer than that. I've been in the program since 2020. So I really don't want to drag it any more than I already have. So May or December of 26.
What's your dissertation?
So my dissertation is basically looking at disability as a lens to study different life narratives. So I'm studying, traditional life narratives, which are memoirs. I'm studying disability memoirs, but I'm also looking at what I consider to be the 21st century form of the memoir. So I'm studying podcasts, YouTube videos, TikTok videos by disabled people. And I'm studying, basically my argument is that disability kind of shifts the way that we tell stories. So I'm looking at these different narrative forms and looking at it from a disability lens and seeing what's different about them. Yeah. So yeah, that's basically the dissertation.
So what's your hypothesis? How does disability change the narrative, do you think?
So far I'm in the very early phases of the research. Actually, I'm doing my comprehensive exams right now and I'm using the same reading materials. And so far from what I've read so far, disability really shapes the way that people kind of tell our stories. And if we think about things like, and this is an interesting question for blind writers, for example, like if a blind writer would really speak from that, this is also the reason why I'm choosing memoirs. If a blind person, let's say a blind person from birth is telling stories, would they be able to use visual descriptions? How much of their stuff is told visually? Whereas would they be using a lot more different imagery? Let's say sound imagery or tactile imagery. So I'm looking at things like that. I'm looking at these little variations. Blindness is one example. And one interesting thing that I've noticed too is people who are neurodivergent kind of tell their stories in a different way. There's one memoir on my list that I've yet to read. It's in the pipeline, but it's written by somebody who is they're on the autism spectrum, and when they wrote their memoirs, the language is different. It's not if you would ask somebody to look at it, they would say, you know, the language is messy. But their editor from their publisher decided not to correct any of those and leave it the way that the author wrote it. So these are things that I'm looking at and seeing how disability has shifted the ways that these stories are told. Because before, if we didn't consider disability, those would get edited out and it might not be as authentic as it would be. So these are things that I'm looking at. So as I've said, the research is kind of in its very early phases for memoirs, and then for other materials like podcasts or videos, I'm also looking at how the technology kind of mediates the disability. The technology kind of compensates for the things that disabled people may not otherwise have or not be able to access without technology. And I'm looking at how technology is kind of changing the game and making things a lot more equitable and, you know, really opening up the avenues for disabled people to tell their own stories.
By the way, just a side note, Marco, you are speaking to two blind writers right now. Me and Peter.
And I, and Annie, I have heard Annie come on, so Annie's also
here. Yeah, she's a writer also.
A writer also.
Might be others listening at the moment too, so you have an audience that you're
Anthony
really
too, actually has a memoir who's a part of the audience, so we get, there are four of us who are a part of this call.
And we have somebody on next week who's got a memoir out too.
Right. So, right. Yeah, I was sort of thinking about your comment, Aunt Marco, and for me, I made a deliberate choice. Even though I know about sighted imagery, I was born totally blind, to not include, you know, I didn't use very many visual images. It's all, or almost all audio and tactile.
Right.
Is the stuff that I, but it was a deliberate choice. I could have, you know, used some of the visual stuff, but I made the choice not to. And for what it's worth, it was sort of interesting that when I was.
Yeah. Again, this is also something that I noticed because I'm kind of collecting my journal entries and expanding them to practically write my memoir. And well, just a little bit of a background. I had low vision until I was 21. And I noticed that the stuff I wrote when I was younger, when I had vision left, was very, very different from the stuff I've written when I totally lost sight. And that's one of the inspirations for the dissertation. I was like, if I unconsciously did this, there must be something. This ability must have changed the way I tell my stories. And I'm also the same. When I look at my material, the creative stuff I've written, even the creative stuff, the fiction stuff that I've written, after I've lost sight, there are slight variations. I at first I wasn't sure if it's because I've been writing a lot and been improving, but I also kind of noticed that there are these slight differences. And one of the things that I've noticed was my imagery, the imagery that I'm using. And because it was silly to me that I didn't think of it, but because after losing sight, my experiences have become a lot more auditory, a lot more tactile. And it would follow that the stuff that I write would be the same. And so I kind of think that if it's like that for blindness, it must be similar for other disabilities. And this is also the reason why I chose life narratives, memoirs to be specific as my main literature for this study. I really kind of feel like there's something there that needs to be looked at that hasn't been looked at yet.
Interesting. So you were born and raised in the Philippines, is that correct?
Born and raised in the Philippines. I am an international student.
Talk about your upbringing. What was it like being blind in the Philippines? You know, so talk about that part of your life.
It's a little hard. The Philippines doesn't have a piece of legislation as robust as the ADA or the Americans with Disabilities Act. And growing up, you know, I'm pushing 40. So, you know, being in grade school in the early 90s with low vision was really hard. And even at that time too, we barely understood what low vision was. And I was actually misdiagnosed. I wasn't properly diagnosed until I was like 9 or 10. My official diagnosis is ROP because I'm a premature baby. But before that, my ophthalmologists were just, you know, prescribing glasses every 6 months or so because my vision was progressively deteriorating and I didn't get a proper diagnosis until I was like 9 or 10. So my school was really hard. I didn't, at least before maybe fifth grade or so, before my diagnosis, it was hard because I didn't have all the proper tools. But it got a lot better, especially after technology started coming in the late 90s, early 2000s. And I have family here in the States, and they started getting stuff for me from different places here in the States for my assistive devices. So it's a little hard. If there are studies that say that for developing countries like the Philippines, we are at least 10 to 15 years behind in terms of tech and other assistive stuff. So I'm a little lucky that we have resources. I have family here in the States that kind of helped out and sent me all my assistive stuff. But it's a little difficult. Even now, if you think about it, I would still say that I think it's safe to say that we're still 10, 15 years behind in terms of technology. And yeah, but schools too. We, as I've said, we don't have legislation as robust as the ADA. So it's a little hard. It's a little tougher for blind students back home in the Philippines. It's basically take care of yourself. And we rely a lot on nonprofits and, you know, a lot of blind organizations for assistance and stuff like that. We, a lot of universities actually, we don't have support services. So we have to go to third party organizations to get our stuff taken care of. So it's a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, I would imagine it is. And my understanding is you went to school in the Philippines, you got your degree, and you've done a lot of teaching in the Philippines and advocacy work. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure.
About your transition to here, to the United States.
So yeah, my bachelor's degree is in English ed. I studied at the Philippine Normal University. It's the country's national center for teacher education. But 1 year a semester of my degree was here in the States with the Global Undergraduate Exchange Program, another U.S. Department of State program. I was at the University of Southern Indiana in Evansville, so I was on exchange. I was actually the world's first blind grantee for that program. And yeah, so, and in the same university is where I also taught after I got my master's degree. I'm teaching in a teacher education program. I'm really a teacher through and through. I was trained as a teacher. I'm teaching in a teacher ed program, you know, teaching pre-service teachers. So it's really my passion. Teaching is one of my passions. And yeah, which links quite nicely to my advocacy back home, which is teacher ed. I do a lot of outreach for teacher training. For the university, I go around the country a lot, doing some inclusive teacher training. Primarily focused on blind tech and how blind tech can be used in the classroom and media. I also do a lot of advocacy for media representation, visibility representation in media. It's my research. It's also been my advocacy for the last maybe 4 or 5 years or so. That's been the work. That's the work that I've been doing back home in the Philippines. So
and any successes you can talk about based on your advocacy? You know, what's changed?
Well, so far last year, we just had a bunch of friends and I just came together and we just started organizing, you know, small workshops. And last year we had our first big one around, I think September or October of last year. We had our first workshop. We were funded by the U.S. Embassy in the Philippines and the workshop had over 300 participants from different countries. We were so surprised that we didn't imagine that we would have that many participants, but we had over 300. We were eyeing for about 100. Yeah, so we had our first disability representation and media workshop. We had participants from the journalists, filmmakers, and different universities, students who are studying communications, mass communications and journalism and things like that. So, and we had participants from the Philippines and, you know, different countries in Southeast Asia, Australia. We had participants from the States. We were so surprised that we did. So yeah, and we are kind of setting up for another run of that workshop sometime in the summer. So right around maybe June or July, we're planning to have another run. We've been getting a lot of requests. We've actually gotten a few requests from actually 3 different countries and they want us to run the workshop again. So we're planning to have that workshop again.
On a related subject, Marco, on a related subject, what are the employment like? What is the employment situation of the blind in the Philippines?
Well, a lot of blind folks are underemployed. Well, unemployed and underemployed. And if they are employed, the career options are very limited. A lot of blind folks are teachers. A lot of blind folks are in tech And yeah, so there are very, very limited career options. And I guess it's like a chicken egg kind of argument because as I've mentioned earlier, in terms of technology, we are a little behind. So in terms of, you know, blind people who are in the hard or applied sciences or things like that, or something that's very math heavy, there's very, very few blind people back home that would have those jobs. It's very limited. And that's something that we've been working on, and hopefully it will change pretty soon. But yeah, it's a fairly limited options.
So you came here, I know you were here for a year, as you mentioned, as an exchange student, but my understanding from his bio.
Years ago.
Oh, well, that's a while ago, isn't it?
Yeah. And then for this one, for the doctorate, I'm a Fulbright scholar. I've been here since I'm part of the 2020 cohort. I was supposed to be here in August of 2020, but we know what happened then.
I wasn't certainly able to leave until
January of 2021. And so, but yeah, I tried out for the Fulbright program, and yeah, I'm on a Fulbright scholarship.
So talk about what the Fulbright scholarship is and what it gives its winners. It's, you know, it's awardees, as it were.
All right. So the Fulbright Foreign Student Program is the U.S. Department of State's flagship academic exchange program, and the Philippines is actually the longest running Fulbright program in the world. So the longest continuously running Fulbright program. It's actually celebrating its, if I'm not mistaken, it's like 76th or 77th year in 2024. So Fulbright scholars from different parts of the world get different benefits. And in my country, for the Philippines, we get 2 years of support, of full support from the Fulbright program. And then the rest of the years of the program are usually funded through universities. It's a cost share between Fulbright and the host university. So I get some funding from the universities, and part of it also I get from grants, external grants to fund my study. So I've been basically supporting myself since the third year of the program, because for the Philippines, we only get 2 years of support from Fulbright. So.
And what prompted you to apply for the Fulbright in the first place? And what's the application process like?
Well, so as I've mentioned, I was part of the Global Undergraduate Exchange Program. It's a non-Fulbright program, but it's administered by the Fulbright Commission. It's for undergrad. So that's when I applied first, as I've said, as an undergrad 14 years ago. And that's when I met the other, you know, my seniors were in the Fulbright program, and I said, as soon as I'm eligible for a Fulbright, I'm going to try out for a Fulbright, because I really enjoyed my time on exchange studying here in the States. It's a lot easier, as I've mentioned, because, you know, of tech and disability services. And I said, if I'm going to go to grad school, I'm going to go back to the States. And since I cannot afford it, I'm going to try out for a Fulbright. So as soon as I was eligible, this was for the 2018 application cycle, I tried out. My goal was, I just wanted to see what the process was like. I told myself, I'm not going to get in. I just wanted to see what the process was like so that the following year I would make a better application. But my first try, I got into the program. So the application process is very rigorous. I believe that for my cohort, that was for the 2018 application cycle, there were nearly 1,000 applications. And it's basically a lot of writing that goes into the application. So you're required to write a research proposal. You're required to submit sample of scholarly writing. And there's a lot of personal essays that you need to write. So it's a lot of writing. It's basically building an academic and career portfolio. And yeah, so there were about 1,000 who tried out in 2018, and they selected, I think, about 40 of us for interviews. It was a series of interviews. We were interviewed by folks locally, and we had representatives from the U.S. Department of State. And then we were narrowed down until we were 11. So we were 11 grantees for the 2020 cohort. So it's a long process. the application started in 2018 and we didn't leave for our program until basically 2020. So it was basically 2 years of selection processes and stuff like that.
That sounds really intense.
It is. It really is.
Super intense. I was always curious because I've met other Fulbright scholar winners and, you know, occasionally they come across our desk when we evaluate scholarships for ACB. And I was always curious. So talk about your experience in the United States. You talked about a little bit, but what's similar? What's different? What do you like? What did you learn? You know, that kind of thing.
Oh, okay. So I guess I want to start with what's different first. Well, weather-wise, it's super different. I'm from the Philippines. It's a tropical country. And now I'm in Western PA. It's in the Northeast. Winters are really harsh here, although the last couple of winters were really mild, but 21 and 22 were really heavy. And, you know, as a blind person, I'm not a guide dog user. I'm a cane user.
Me too.
So traveling in the snow with a cane is just rough. It was something that I really had to get used to. And I arrived here like dead of winter. It was January of 2021. And so I didn't have enough time to train for, you know, cane travel in the snow. It was like, okay, you're here. It's snowing everywhere. Go ahead. And I was like, okay. So that was really difficult for me. It just messes everything up. Aside from not having all your usual cues on the ground, everything is just dampened with the snow. So I cannot use all of my usual sound cues because everything's just muffled with snow everywhere. So that's one thing that's very, very different.
Marco, if I may, I just want to say, don't feel bad. I'm raising Cain too.
I know. So yeah, really honestly, like I was so happy this winter that we had a very, very mild winter over here in Western PA. So I was like, yeah. So it was something that's very different. Although I don't really mind the cold. It's really cane travel in the snow. That's very, very different. Yeah. Similar. What's similar, I guess, is I really enjoy hanging out with blind folks, and which is really why I enjoyed convention last year, getting to hang out with my friends from ACB and Blind Pride International. It doesn't really matter that, you know, I'm an international student, but when I hang out with my blind friends, it feels easier. You know, I don't need to explain to my blind friends what I'm doing and why I'm doing things this way. You know, people get it. So it's the same back home. It's something that I really miss, you know, hanging out with my blind friends, which is why I really, really enjoyed convention last year when we were in Schaumburg.
You have taught both here and in the Philippines, if I understand your.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Talk about sort of the differences and similarities in sort of your teaching experiences in both countries.
Mm-hmm.
And the students you're teaching.
Well, I don't know. So here's the thing. I really noticed differences with my students back home and here, but I really don't know I'm pretty sure that there's something cultural going on. My students back home in the Philippines are a lot more, I say a lot more independent. Like I can leave instructions with my kids back home at the university and they'd find ways to go about it. But my students here, I have to do a little more hand holding, but I don't know if that's cultural because I'm suspecting that the pandemic had a lot to do with it. So I really can't say that it's cultural. I'm actually suspecting that more of it is the pandemic's fault. I really find that my students here, especially I handle English 101 courses at the university here in Indiana, and a lot of them I feel are a lot more socially, I wouldn't say socially inept, but yeah, socially awkward, but I really do feel like because these were the kids who had at least a year or maybe nearly 2 years of high school on Zoom. So suddenly being, you know, in person, it was a bit jarring for them. So I really think there's something going on there with the pandemic. I'm not sure if it's cultural, but I'm pretty sure the pandemic has a lot to do with that. They're a lot more like socially, as I've said, I have to manage them a little more. I have to encourage them to work in groups because nobody wants to work in groups, especially in person. Mm-hmm. So these are things that I kind of noticed were different. But as I've said, I really think the pandemic did that.
Think in the future that things will reverse themselves? I mean, COVID was a good excuse. I don't know how much longer it can be. So I'm wondering if in the future things will revert back to the way they once were.
I hope so. I really do hope so. I think I'm pretty sure that maybe in a few years when we get the students in the first year students in the universities who really had their entire middle school and high school in person, I think it would go back to normal. I'm optimistic that it would go back to normal. But I think there are also some changes that there are changes that are good that happened because of the pandemic, but there are also things that are kind of less than ideal, but I'm optimistic. I'm pretty sure that it would go back to normal. I hope so.
Right.
Oh, one quick question, Bob. I think it's getting time for audience participation, but
just about.
Yes. But I did want to sort of make an observation. Traditionally, we in the United States are more individualistic than Asian countries like the Philippines.
Yes.
Do you experience that? Is that something that rings true
with your
experience in both countries?
I really do think so. I really do think so. Teaching back home, I find that students work all right with groups. Here, there are some students who would really prefer to work alone. And I allow that in class. Like if a student would tell me I would prefer to work alone, I'd allow that. I have no problems with that because I think that's a major difference. We are a lot more group oriented generally, and a lot of Western cultures, including the States, are a lot more individualistic. So yes, that's probably one difference that I've noticed as a teacher. Thank you for bringing that up. That's really something that.
Yeah. No,
you're listening to In Perspective, and my name is Bob Branco and my co-host is Peter Alchil. We're here with ACB scholarship winner Marco Ramos. Should I call you Ramos or Ramos?
Ramos.
Not sure if I'm doing this right.
It's Spanish. My
Ramos.
My grandpa is Spain Spanish. So, it's Ramos. Yep.
Ramos. Okay. If anybody wants to talk to Marco Ramos, this is your opportunity now to raise your hands and ask questions of our guests. So let me turn the festivities briefly over to Trish to find out if there are, in fact, any hands raised.
Yes, we do. The first one is Sharon. Go ahead, Sharon.
Sharon from
Hello.
Massachusetts.
Hi, Marco. This has been
Sharon.
Fascinating.
Hi.
Okay. I have a comment and a question. This is back to your PhD. The comment is, I'm hoping that when you explore memoirs of people with disabilities that you consider people that have chronic illnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And one memoir that I had forgotten about but just came back to me that you might want to look at is, I think it's called Salt in My Soul, and it's about a young woman who had cystic fibrosis, and she actually died from it, but it was just such a detailed memoir of her emotions and her everydayness as somebody struggling with a disability, but also her fitting into the society, and I just thought it was a remarkable webinar. So, and I think that a lot of people now are dealing with a lot of chronic illnesses. And I don't know if you want to consider blindness. I consider it a chronic something to deal with. I don't consider it an illness. But anyway, and my question is, are you aware of any podcasts, disability related podcasts that are not kind of like how to and techie, but are more related to the lifestyle and the experience of disability? Thank you.
Okay. So one of the podcasts that I really like, well, she passed away last year, but Judith Heumann's podcast is a favorite. There's also the Accessible Stall. It's by, I need to double check. I don't want to But it's the accessible stall. It's by a couple of folks who have mobility impairments, and they talk a lot about advocacy, but they also talk about lifestyle. They guest people with different disabilities, talking about their careers and things like that. It's one of my favorites.
Are you saying accessible stall? Like STALL?
Accessible stall.
Okay, that's yes, unusual.
Yeah, because I think they're kind of playing with, like, you know, the idea of the accessible stall in bathrooms and how
it kind of started there.
So,
okay.
I'm wondering what you meant by stall. Okay.
Okay.
I think that's what they're playing around with. It's a very, very good podcast. Really funny.
Okay. Thank you.
Your comment reminds the question, the discussion about how various disabilities impact the writing. I wonder how the writing, we all have visible disabilities, we're all blind. And so it's pretty clear, although it's not always the case for blind people, but generally people see us and they know something is weird about us, quote unquote weird. But it's not always true. There are invisible disabilities, people with psychiatric disabilities, people on the autism spectrum. I wonder how the language changes based on the visibility of the disability.
So far, I've noticed that it would change, really. As I've mentioned earlier, I have forgot the title, but I have that memoir on my list of that person who's on the autism spectrum, and the language is different a little bit. So, and also, I guess with the themes and issues that people are dealing with, they would differ as well. Like, we don't have to go so far. We have our friends who have low vision, who may not be instantly, their disabilities might not be instantly observable.
Right.
And so their experience with blindness might be different. And so the themes that they might be talking about would be different as well. So aside from language, I'm also looking at thematic differences and seeing how a disability kind of plays a part in that.
And we do have more hands.
Let's do it.
Okay. Let's have the next one.
Actually, by the way, how many hands do we have approximately?
Right now, two, but that could very easily change.
Well, that's fine. So, I just wanted to get a sense of what we're dealing with.
Okay. Next is Tony.
Welcome, Tony.
Thank you very much, Marcos. I'm very impressed with you. Two points of information. Then I do have a question. I just looked it up. You have the Magna Carta of disability.
Yes.
And it's 1992 when I guess the entire world was imitating the Americans with Disability Act. Very, very detailed and all that, and how that translates into everyday life. You've made the comment that probably it's not quite as strong as here.
Don't get me started on that.
Okay. All right. My memoir is full of visual environmental descriptions because I was partially sighted growing up.
Right.
So it's way back to the very beginning of our conversation. So that's what happened. And it probably became more and more auditory or less and less visual the later into my life I was going. So now here's my question. Given that the difference in the robustness of the laws and probably the cultural differences, do you find it is faster and easier for people to accept you, as, let's say, an equal here in the United States than maybe in the Philippines? Is there like a time differential for acceptance between the two cultures?
Hmm. Wow, that's an interesting question. I'd like to think that there isn't, but now that I'm thinking a little bit more about it, I kind of think that there are slight differences. It feels like back home, I kind of have to prove myself more than I do as here. Here I still do, but it feels a little easier. So this is something that I didn't think of until you brought up that question. So I think so. I think there are slight differences. It feels, I think the best word that I can describe it, living with a disability here in the States feels less restrictive. And, when I go to like somewhere like the disability office, they get it. I don't have to tell him what's happening. You know, my disability support officers, and I have a great team working with me, Dr. Dugan and Dr. Van Wieren from IUP. I come to them and they know what's happening. I don't have to explain myself a lot. So I do feel that it's a little easier.
Okay.
Thanks, Marcos.
Thank you very much, Tony. And who do we have next?
All right. We currently have two. So the first one is Pam Coffey.
Hello, Pam.
Hello. My question is sort of similar in that I'm wondering if you find differences in people's writing style, memoir style, not so much, well, not only between low vision and no vision at various points in their lives, but do you find that there are differences between those who received their education in public schools, mainstream channels, as opposed to those who received their education at a school for the blind or school for the deaf and blind or anyway, a special school, specialized school?
Interesting. This is something that I haven't thought about. This might be something for me to pay attention to. Mm-hmm. The more that I'm reading my stuff, I didn't think about this. Thank you for bringing this up. This is interesting. I really did not consider it. I'm pretty sure I would. Okay. Thank you. This is something that I honestly, I haven't thought about. So this is pretty interesting to me too. I'll let you know the more I read if I notice differences.
Yes.
Thank you. I appreciate that. This is something.
Well, this is intersectionality. Really interesting. Right?
Yeah.
The question I was going to ask you, which Pam's question reminded me of is there an age difference? That is making this up. If people who wrote their memoirs after the age of 50, how might they be different than those who wrote their memoirs prior to the age of, I don't know, 35? You understand the question I'm asking.
Mm-hmm.
Years of publication, you know.
Years of publication, age, definitely. Yep.
Yeah.
So trends. That's something that I've already noticed. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's lots of variables that you can think about if you choose. The challenge you may have is narrowing down your focus.
Exactly. Yeah. Right now, because I'm in the comprehensive phase of the program, my comprehensive exam phase, it's really supposed to be broad.
Sure.
But when it comes when time comes that I need to write the dissertation, it has to be narrowed down. So I have to narrow it down to a particular focus. I might keep it to a particular time period, or I might limit it to specific types of memoirs, because right now there are certain themes that are popping up with my reading for my comprehensive. So I would really need to narrow it down, because right now I'm really starting to see a few different directions that the study can go. So.
Well, good luck. The hard part in my experience is narrowing the focus. You know,
It really is.
You can go so many different directions. So anyway, thank you, Pam. That's great. It's a great question.
And, Trish, I think we have one more.
Or
do we?
We actually have three hands, right?
All right.
Now.
Well, let's do it.
Let's bring them on.
The next one is Ann Chipetta. Hello, everybody.
Hi.
Hi, Marco and Bob and Peter. I just wanted to say I'm very intrigued by your PhD project. And, you know, when I wrote my memoir, part of it was about growing up visually impaired, and the other part of it was being visually impaired and as an adult. So I was wondering if you came across anything like that, where a person, you know, described their, you know, their early childhood when, you know, they weren't completely overcome by their visual impairment versus, you know, later on in the book, maybe, you know, their young adulthood or their adulthood, they're completely transformed by their disability. That just made me think about, you know, what I did in my book, and if there's other books like that out there, or if you ever considered you know, okay, having a theme so, like that.
Yeah, I cannot think of titles so far because right now for my comprehensives, I'm in my theory section. So a lot of the reading that I've done so far is theory-based, working a lot with critical disability and literary disability theory. But I cannot think about, I've read a few memoirs, but I think my blind and visually impaired memoirs are still latter down in my list. So I cannot think of titles to give right now.
Yeah.
Cause the memoirs that I've read so far deal a lot with, you know, psychosocial.
And
mental illness so far. Cause I'm working my way down to different disabilities. So.
Gosh.
Yeah, this is something that I'm pretty sure is going to pop up later when I start reading my blind and visually impaired memoirs. I'm pretty sure it's going to pop up later on. Yeah.
So if it does pop up, let me know. But there was this one book that I read when I was going through my undergrad, and it was by Robert V. Hines, V-I-N-E-S, and he had lost his vision, regained it, and lost it again over a period of 30 years. Yeah.
I think this is on my list.
Was
yes
wow I yeah so
this is that, on my list
oh good I'm glad because that was that so, was a very powerful yes. book yeah so anyway good luck to you and thank you. You so much for coming on and I look forward to you know to your work and maybe we'll meet up one day at convention
hopefully
thanks Ann.
Thank you Annie.
Okay. Next we have Sharon.
You can take other. Are there other raised hands before me, Trish? Is that all right?
Well, there is another one, but Tony has also spoken, so.
Oh, okay. Okay. So first of all, from Annie. Is it Robert Bynes, B-I-N-E-S? Is that what you think it is, Markle?
The yes. name is,
okay.
Yeah, I believe and, so.
Okay.
It's Bynes as in Victor.
Vigna, oh, Bynes. Yes. Okay. Yes. Oh, thank you. Okay. Thank you, Annie. And then I was thinking about you're going to be really culling through a lot of data. And I wondered if you have thought about in any way using AI in some way to facilitate your research. And then my other question is when it's all said and done, is it something that you are able to publicly share with us as a community?
Yeah. Well, okay. So answering the AI thing first. Yeah. Not really to synthesize data, but I'm using it a lot to make data management a lot easier. So for example, when I encounter a book or an article that I feel like I need to include in my list, I automatically feed it through an AI and ask AI to write my citation for me. And I only need to double check that citation and put it in the list. So things like that, I haven't really figured out a way to use it for synthesizing data or something like that. I only use AI for, as I've said, citations or whenever I have, because what I do with my comprehensive exams, every 10 or 15 books, I practice writing the exam format. Because for my program, we are asked to write 3 15-page essays in 7 days. So what I do after I finish 15 books, I kind of practice writing a 15-page paper in 2.5 or 3 days or things like that. So I use AI to speed up whenever I need to grammar check or things like that. So that's the extent of how I use AI.
That's excellent. That's good. Yeah.
Yeah. It makes it easier, especially that I'm a screen reader user. So having the AI check the grammar and stuff is a lot easier now to do it that way. And what's the second part of the question?
Would you be able to share your work?
Oh yeah. Well, the goal is, when the dissertation is finished, it will be uploaded in databases. Our partners, ProQuest. So for folks who are in the scholarly area, it would be available via ProQuest. And hopefully I'm planning to publish the dissertation as a monograph, as a book later on, of course. So that's also something. And definitely I can talk about the study when it's finished. I'd hope I'd be able to do that.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Sharon.
Thanks, Sharon. And I believe we have Tony on deck.
Okay, I am here. Next. Okay, Tony's already lowered his hand, and then we have one more after Tony.
Oh, this is just some quick advice for Marco so he survives the rest of his doctoral program. being somebody who is one of the, I'm one of the millions of ABDs in the world, all but dissertations. So I know what you can do to not finish your dissertation. So you are permitted to fall in love. You are not permitted to play the field. You must take every single question you get asked in these forums, and you should expose yourself a lot to these things and make sure you mark down, like, what were the variables that maybe you will, you know about, but you're not going to deal with, because believe me, the dissertation committee is going to really want to know, I do know about these variables, but for this reason or that reason, I excluded them.
Yep.
And most important of all, keep the pressure on yourself to finish in 2026 like you're planning to do. And then you will be successful, my friend.
Thank you. Thanks, Tony. Thanks for those tips today. I really
do. We have about 4 minutes left in the program, so it gives you just a little bit of time.
You want to take one more hand?
Yes, we will.
Okay, so we'll take Alice, and she hasn't spoken yet. Go ahead, Alice Massa.
Thank you, and congratulations, Marco, on all of your accomplishments. And I just have a quick question for you. Can you briefly tell us something about a couple of your other academic publications?
So I have a couple pending. I have one on disability and humor. It's the way that disabled folks use humor whenever they tell stories about disability, as it's basically humor as a cushion to talk about something uncomfortable. So I have one that's pending publication. Hopefully I just revised it. So hopefully it's going to be out soon, but yeah, I just turned in my revision. So that's one thing that I'm doing. So I'm studying disabled comedians and analyzing how they're using disability as a cushion to talk about something that's uncomfortable for many people.
Any other publications you're either out or will be out?
I have one that I submitted on Homegoing. It's a novel by Yajiasi. Basically, I'm talking about, my argument there is that whenever we talk about slavery, it's always race and gender, but we forget that slavery is a disability producing condition. Mm-hmm. So that whenever we talk about slavery, disability should always be part of that equation. So that's another paper that I've written. It's also pending review. I just submitted that to a publication. So I have a couple that's pending review right now.
Let us know when you publish a lot of your work. We can have access to it if it gets
sure,
to that point.
Sure.
We'd be interested.
That's and really, I we don't have into sharing to, those. Yeah.
But that whole issue of slavery is and disability is a really, I never thought about that, but that's a real thing, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah, both psychiatrically and physical and
physically.
All kinds of
yes.
Stuff. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, you bet. Wow, I never thought about that. Any other hands raised?
We have 1 minute. We can take.
Well, we have Ann Tribetta's hand is up.
You got about. You got about 1 minute, Ann. You can.
Okay, I just wanted to do a correction. It's Robert V. Hines, H-I-N-E, and he wrote the book Second Sight. And so that's the book that I misquoted.
So it's Robert V as in victory, H-I-N-E-S.
H-I-N-E-S.
H-I-N-E, no S.
Oh, no S.
No S. Yeah. Not like a ketchup. No
okay.
S.
All right. Thank you, Annie.
Thanks again, Ann. We appreciate it. Marco, you have really made your mark, and we appreciate all that you're doing and continued success. And like
Thank
I
you.
Said, we look forward to reading some of your work. So once it's available, please let us know.
I definitely will do that.
And at that time, not only do we want to have access to it on our own, but we would like to have you back on the show to follow up.
Sure. Yeah. Yep.
So let's
talk in a year or so and see how you're doing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, please.
I'd love to.
Please.
Thank you.
Thanks for appearing. Next week, speaking of authors with memoirs, we're going to have a lady on our show, Mary O'Brien. She'll be on next week to discuss her memoir. It's her autobiography. She's a graduate of Perkins School. She'll talk to us all about that. But in the meantime, thank you, Trish. Thank you, Peter. Thank you to our participants. And again, happy Easter, everybody, and go safe with God's abundant blessings. My name is Bob Branko. Peace be with all of you. And see you next week on In Perspective.